And we are burning down the house here in our new time slot every Wednesday at 8 on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. A continuing conversation about the culture of architecture in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, passions, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment.
Curtis, just want to remind you that this show is brought to you by
Fairway Markets.
All right.
I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Fairway Markets in New York, Manhattan, two locations, Brooklyn and Red Hook. A fabulous resource for the building materials of life, everything related to good food and good living. And that is what we as architects are all about, improving the quality of living. This evening in studio, our guest is Professor Roderick L. Knox. But before we get into our discussion, our topic this evening, architecture and eloquence, some late breaking news. In the world of offenses against the landscape, visual victims, and heinous crimes against our patrimony of the built environment must be investigated and prosecuted wherever they occur. This is one story of a visual victim. Dateline Chicago. No sooner than celebrations had been planned should Chicago have gotten the bid for the Olympics, but that the demolition of a Walter Gropius-designed hospital pavilion at the Michael Reese Medical Center on the south side of Chicago commenced. Demolition of the Friends Pavilion, a very beautiful Bauhaus-style and informed pavilion. And this is what the city of Chicago had to say about removing this building, because it was inconvenient. What they said was, it's not viable for us. People are saying we should save these buildings, but in the meantime, we have to be responsible to the taxpayers. And so instead of maintaining some beautiful, iconic, modern buildings, which would have so much for younger architects and lay people to learn from, after only 50 years, these structures are being demolished. So first was the Friends Pavilion. Next will be the Michael Reese Powerhouse, a gem of a beautiful, beautiful Bauhaus, utilitarian and yet modern, clean, reasoned structure. That will be next. I will post pictures of these in the blog. If you find these acts of taxpayer responsibility outrageous, please write to Mayor Richie Daley and express your dissatisfaction with Chicago's disregard for its architectural patrimony. Now, that's not the tone of the discussion that I really had in mind, but these wanton acts of desecration of the landscape needed to be noted. We want to talk about eloquence of surviving architecture. Let's have a little uplifting march music from Prokofiev as we march into the future. Thank you. This is Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Jack Inslee is our producer, and Nat Wiener is our engineer this evening, and Rod Knox, professor at Cooper Union, is our guest. Eloquence in architecture. The unabridged dictionary defines eloquence as fluency, force, appropriateness, in an appeal to reason. Well, one of the reasons that I chose that little introductory music is because I designed an opera set in 1976 for the Dutch National Opera. For that opera, that's from Love of Three Oranges by Sergei Prokofiev, and it's a spry and, shall I say, fluent, forceful, and appropriate piece of music to start off our discussion of architecture and eloquence. This will be part one of a series. This evening, we're going to talk about architecture and eloquence from the master's point of view, and in subsequent evenings over the next 2 weeks, we will hear from students of Professor Knox as they explain to us what they find eloquent in architecture based on their studies. But first, we, the old masters, are going to talk about what we find eloquent. Today in class, I sat in with Rod and his students, and he told a little story about the experience of going to the Villa Savoy, a pavilion in a cow field in France designed by Le Corbusier. Tell us about that basin that you were mentioning.
Oh, I never noticed it before, not in plans or...
When you look at the drawings.
When I look at the drawings, and I saw this this freestanding sink. And as you walk in, it's right there. That's what greets you, and you, so you can wash your hands. And it really
after your dusty voyage.
Yes, after you kicked up all that dust with the cars.
Before you enter into the ramp that takes you up into the piano nobile.
Yeah,
and that is an eloquent gesture to the visitors, and there's something almost Islamic about that. That you should ablute yourself before you enter this pristine pavilion.
Yeah.
And have you seen other eloquent gestures in other buildings that you can think of?
Well, I think any building that arrests your attention does it through eloquence, and it's eloquence is, I suppose, it should be a sort of fluency and a clarity and an honesty where you can see that there is truth being addressed, that there is no cover up, that there is. Veneer is kept to a minimum, and when veneer is used, it somehow reflects what maybe it's used for expediency, but it reflects the intent of the material that it might be imitating.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier, that as an architect, expressing what you mean and what you believe is, and that sort of honesty, whether people agree with you or not, is the mark of truly doing right by the environment and by your client, and that to play funny games, to be amusing at your own pleasure, is dishonest and wrong.
And also...
I know that sounds sort of Calvinistic.
No, it's not, because it's the biggest investment you'll ever make. And it's serious business as an owner, and it's serious business, and you want to know that your architect is
being straight with you.
Yes, and if you must, as an architect, you have to be. If you lose your client's trust, you can't function anymore. It's no different than a doctor or a lawyer. I mean, you really have to, when you do, when you, you have to be careful about your lies. And I'm not pretending to be a truth teller at all times, but I think that if you can tell the truth, people lie for no good reason. And architects do it. It's a sort of...
Can you give us an example of that? An architectural lie?
I see. Well, we all...
Without becoming too Jesuitical here about the degrees of white lies that are acceptable.
One example
that I think that I've heard you make is that many of Frank Gehry's structures suggested that it's a thin shell structure, but in fact it's got a very heavy real structure under the titanium shells. That would be an example, wouldn't it?
Yes, it's an example, but the way he expresses the structure, He's an architect, and you as an architect that a folded plate or a warp structure adds rigidity to the material.
Right, it's inherently structural.
Yes, and when you do that, you expect that. You expect it to be performing a structural function. And you can say, my God, isn't that wonderful that the man has found the material... The structure, the material, and the technology, which is the foundation of all styles. You know, those three elements come together, and when you find out that it's all fake, it's such a disappointment, because architecture is not easy, and it's hard to solve problems, and. That is what you do. It's an art, but it's not the kind of art that you paint what you see. It's an art that doesn't give you much latitude, and you have to do this art without putting the client through an added expense.
And how much more eloquent would the Disney Concert Hall in L.A. be if the real roof structure is what you saw? Rather than that just being a warped shingle over a real structure.
Over a steel frame. And, not only that. I think it seems a little bit, we all, know that you never know what's going to happen. But a big mistake, you don't, in all your studies, you didn't realize that this thing was going to act like a parabolic mirror and concentrate the sun and
fry your neighbors and blind the adjacent motorists passing by. Yes,
and you have to then go and someone wrote a book. This guy Silber, it's called Architecture of the Absurd, where he really shows examples of how these extravagant structures that are done. To attract attention, really end up. I suppose they're
just,
worth it.
They're just set designs. The set design that I did for Love of Three Oranges, which was canvas over foam with a paint job.
I mean, he points out that at MIT, he does this. Frank Gehry goes and he has this idea that, let's have this indoor street where everybody's open and you can see the professors at work and so on.
And that's a wonderful idea.
Yes, but he didn't speak to the professors, and they don't really want to be. They want a door.
I see. Well, of course, I would want a door.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need to shut the door.
You need to shut things out, and so they have to go and build these. Ad hoc partitions because these guys don't want to be exposed. And it seems to me that you just can't have these ideas and not test them first. Or you have to talk to the client And I mean, it's a further expense for the client to go and make the building work.
So what I think I'm hearing you say is that truly eloquent design and architecture comes from being in touch with the foundation of principles of how the people are going to use the space and being true to the materials and not telling tales of, oh, yes, this is going to be great, without consulting a foundation of reality about, in that case, how the space will be used in the society of professors and students at MIT.
Yes, eloquence is not anything goes. Eloquence is a structure, it's a routine, it's all these things that we don't like. Your job is to make them work and work beautifully. Your job is very difficult to do. You can making sculpture for living in is not is mocking architecture. Architects never did make sculpture for living in.
When you say that, I'm reminded of the Monsanto House of the Future. That was at Disneyland. I don't know if you And they'd also made an appearance at the 1964-65 World's Fair.
Yeah.
And so it was a molded plastic pod that somehow we tried to adapt furniture to. Of course, it was pod-shaped, and there is a reason that most of us live in orthogonal houses, because it works with the way that we live with our furniture.
Yeah.
And that would not be eloquent, but then
it would be eloquent if you didn't bring conventional furniture.
If you just had beanbag chairs and you slept in a round waterbed, then
or an airplane can be eloquent.
Absolutely.
Because it is
a perfect engineering solution.
Yes.
Towards moving this great mass of stuff through the air.
Yes.
And previously we've spoken about how truly eloquent buildings will speak to you if you spend the time to engage them and look at them. Will tell you their story without you having to have the playbook or the guidebook to tell you all about that. Can you think of any?
Well, most buildings in Lower Manhattan is a textbook of structure. You all of these guys went and spent time at the Beaux Arts, and they learned how to detail and they learn the classical language of
in ways that are delightful using the materials of the cladding.
When you know the arch is veneer, but the arch is true. It's looking at a drawing of an arch, how an arch should be made. All the coursing is true. Everything is true. Even though it's stone wallpaper, yes. And, that sort of eloquence where it's a lie. It's on a steel frame. But it's forgivable because it gives you... We also are not happy with just a bare minimum. That's what the Bauhaus learned too late. That's why no one pays much attention to the Gropius structure, because people do like embellishments, and ornament is crime,
and I suppose a taste for modern composition might be an acquired taste. I mean, it's not when you look at the companion blog, which will be posted in the next couple of days, you'll have a look at these buildings, and they're all about abstract composition. Very tight, linear expression of materials. Nothing like the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, which has its arches, but yes, also in addition, has delightful ornament. where there's a play of daylight on the form. These are crystalline, hard structures of planes and volumes in space. But I have no doubt that in their time they were very utilitarian. So perhaps they're not eloquent, even though we can learn something, could have learned something from them.
I mean, like, let's take a Schroeder house. I consider that an eloquent house, even
though...
That's
Gerrit Rietveld, and it's in Utrecht in the Netherlands.
I mean, it is. There's a lot of fakery going on, but the intention is there. It is supposed to be expressing a material of the time, reinforced concrete, even though he didn't have the wherewithal to make it as all reinforced concrete. It's just a core that's reinforced concrete.
And the rest is painted stucco.
Yes. But the intention is there, and it is, it's true to reinforced concrete. And you go inside, and the house is... It wouldn't suit you or people other because there's it's gizmo.
We have no idea what would suit me, but okay.
I would say that there's no privacy. It's just curtains, partitions. I could live in it
all by yourself.
All by myself, yeah, exactly. But
it's a fairly large house, and it's a house intended for a family.
Intended for a family with just a mother, because the father was really out of the picture, and he died and left her this money, and she built this house. And the house.
So it is a one-person pavilion.
It's a one-person pavilion, and I contrast this house with the Farnsworth house. It's the same sort of thing. A woman wants a house
right.
built, and she gets the architect to. But they,
that's by Mies van der Rohe, and it's a one-story pavilion.
Yeah.
Raised up above the floodplain because it's near to a river.
Right.
And there's no privacy because there aren't any drapes even.
Right.
It's just a glass box.
Yes.
In an Illinois hayfield.
Yeah, but the difference is that Trish Schroeder, she had these kids. I think, what were they? They were three kids, two girls and a boy. And their rooms would be just, you pull a partition and there's your bedroom. But in the day, you open it up and you're in the living room. And it must have, for her, it is the womb. I realized that the house was a womb with a view. And those kids were in her womb, And they actually had this... as soon as they became of age, they ran for their lives.
Especially if they were normal Dutch kids, because if you go to Utrecht to see this house, it's this Martian thing in red, white, blue, and mostly white.
A house of cards.
Yeah, a house of cards. In with brick Dutch houses with tile roofs.
Yeah.
And so we have... The Smurfs and the Hobbits live next door. And then here's this Destail house of cards dropped in on a corner lot. And you say, I said to myself when I said, the neighbors must have been really upset.
They had no idea. The drawing that he filed at the building department was the one looking at the house. Yeah, looking at it head on with the outline of the house behind it.
Yeah.
And they thought that was the roof of the house. And so,
well, there's a lie for you.
There's a lie for you. And not only that, the kids actually, when they would never go directly into the house, they would walk past the house with their schoolmates and then double back. Because they would say, I wonder who lives in that crazy house. But in any event, Edith Farnsworth, on the other hand, she was a single woman, a successful doctor. She had money, and she gave this guy a blank check, and he built this pavilion. But it wasn't even a pleasure pavilion because she couldn't, she wanted curtains, and she wanted some privacy, and she also wanted relief from the bugs if she went out on this porch she had. And
that's right.
And he didn't build it high enough off the floodplain, and she had one little window, and the house, it's a beautiful
house. Oh no, it's all windows, really.
It's two floating slabs, and it is, for me, it is a apotheosis of steel. You can't get steel is expressed in that house in such a in a way, because steel, the qualities of steel, where it's equal both in tension and compression.
Yeah.
And it's the only material that can actually operate eccentrically. You know, the slabs are magnetically held to the columns. They can just slide up and down. And he didn't take it all the way to the top.
Metaphorically speaking, yes.
Yeah, and so even the top, you know, it goes a little bit beyond the length of the column.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like it's free to go up and down.
That's right.
And
a great Dr. Farnsworth masher.
Yeah, yeah. She ended up suing him because he thought that his idea was more important than her comfort.
Yeah, and so consequently, it's not exactly an eloquent house.
You know,
let's contrast that with Philip Johnson's glass house in New Canaan, which I think, for what he attempted to do, is very eloquent. The glass house, much like the Farnsworth house, is glass all around with a floating roof plane. But the vertical element, the Z component, the vertical support is really downplayed. You know, that roof slab floats as if it's bearing on the glass wrapper. Much like the conversation we were having earlier today about the ribbon window at the second floor, the Cooper Union Foundation building, where there's a warped plane. It's a piano curve partition, but then there's a ribbon slotted out of it that's glass. And I always found that disturbing, but you found that to be, oh, the partition went from being solid to being glass, and it's all in compression.
Yeah.
And Philip Johnson does a similar thing there, where the glass enclosure around the box seems to be holding up the roof. But then within it are two extremely minimal forms. One is the low rhomboid of the kitchen, and the other is the round
cylinder of
the bathroom. And the bedroom is partitioned off from the rest of the living space by curtains.
Yeah,
and the rest of the privacy is provided by the landscape, because he has right. So many acres that there wouldn't be anybody walking by to see in.
And not only that, there's a sheer drop right
just
off.
Just beyond
it. Yeah, it's beyond it, so that no one could sneak up. So in a way, it's that the glass house is not really a transparent house. The Farnsworth house is a transparent house. Yeah. The glass house is really not transparent because it is alone.
The landscape is the curtain.
Is a curtain.
But yes. I think that the glass house is eloquent.
It's eloquent. It's a house. The Farnsworth, it's really not a house.
The Farnsworth house would work perfectly well for someone who was into high-tech gunnery as a deer blind. You know, just sit up there and wait for animals to come by.
I think... That when you look at a Greek temple and you say, oh my God, what's the big deal? It's just, you know, columns and the lintels. And then you realize, my God, there is no straight line in this damn thing. It's all curves.
Right, the antithesis.
Yeah, everything
is
curved. Curves make straight lines look straighter. And straight lines on their own will curve.
For those of you who didn't go to architecture school in the 20th century, antithesis is this clever trick of the Athenians that in order for the pediment of a portico to look straight, it actually curves.
Right.
With the horizon.
Yes.
Yes.
It compensates for the visual... a conical vision. I mean, and even the columns actually tilt slightly in one direction.
Towards the center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's those little refinements. And when you look at the Farnsworth house, Mies, the reason why it's eloquent, because I am reminded
you think
of...
Do you think that Farnsworth House is eloquent?
Because it's a Greek temple in steel.
I see. Does it have entasis?
I think it does, because those columns could have been thinner, but he fattened them up because they didn't look right. They looked too thin. And so it wasn't just...
Well, so it's not entasis, it's just that that's a matter of scale and proportion.
Then. Yes, yeah. Well, the adjustments the formulas say you can do this, but your gut tells you...
You shouldn't.
It doesn't look right.
Oh, sure. I did a very pedestrian sort of project once. It was an addition to a porte-cochere for some ATMs in a bank. You know, I did banking projects. And almost as a joke, after I did the calculation, I checked it out with my structural engineer. And I only needed 6x6 square tube steel columns to hold up this roof. Now, visually, what he wanted were, say, 2 foot square posts, but it's there to this day in Stamford, Connecticut,
and nobody goes out on it.
Well, they put some bollards around it because if you hit it, it might make a dent. But it didn't look right, but it was what the structural requirements it dictated. And I didn't feel that it was honest in that case to fill it out with concrete or clad it with a stucco box. I made that clear to my client that this is, it looks weird, but it's right. And they haven't messed with it. It is disturbing, however, when you're brutally honest sometimes.
Yeah, well,
that's and I wouldn't say that little renovation was eloquent. It actually, it was sort of perverse.
You know, someone once said, art is a lie that tells the truth, and you make these adjustments to. I have a problem, and something visually says, I shouldn't go out on that balcony. That concrete is too thin. And you thicken it up just to relieve that tension. The Farnsworth House, it's Greek in other ways, too. It's in the approach where you circumnavigate it before you go in it, that sort of thing. Uh-huh. But I think he was wasn't concerned with the client said to him, look, here's a blank check. She met him at a party and found out he's a famous architect. And she says, I got some money and I got a piece of land. I want a pleasure a weekend house. Mm-hmm. And she says, do whatever you want.
But how can the Farnsworth House be eloquent when it doesn't meet the basic environmental requirements of being able to live in a house in a warm part of the Mississippi River, delta in Illinois, where it gets up above 100 degrees in the summer and bitter cold in the winter?
Now, it falls short of being perfect, but it still is eloquent. And the reason why it's eloquent is because it is focused in on the material, and that it is true to steel. And he was building the Seagram's building at the same time, and he was obsessed with steel. That's the only true steel building ever built. He had to after the Seagram's building, it has never been surpassed, because even you have to cover steel with concrete for fireproofing.
Well, but you don't have to fireproof a house.
You don't have to fireproof a house, exactly.
Yes.
And so this is what he wished he could have done on Park Avenue.
I see.
And instead he had to put the bronze over the concrete to bring it back to metal.
Over the steel. Yeah. Yes. Well, let's take a little curvy break.
Okay.
And talk about some curves.
Okay.
Give me some La Boheme.
Oh,
Oh, yeah. There's Musetta. Singing about her life as a high-priced girlfriend in Paris, walking along the boulevards, and how the men turn to watch her walk by. You were saying it's your favorite opera, La Bohème.
Whenever I go, I don't go that quite as often as I should, but when I do go, that's the one I choose.
Well, we can learn a lot about eloquence by studying the masters of music. You know, music and architecture are locked together like lovers in a hot embrace. You know,
but there are degrees of eloquence. You know, and so to answer the question on the Farnsworth House,
all right.
I mean, it is eloquent. It may not be as eloquent as it should have been. Because if he had paid attention, he actually shot himself in the foot, you know, because it could have been, it's okay that...
It could have been better if all that glass was articulated and it opened and breezes blew through.
Yes.
And he could have done something with the proportions so that the air would have flowed naturally and Dr. Farnsworth
he could have
been
made it
happy.
Work, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But who knows what he was thinking? We can't ask him. He's been gone now.
You mentioned Philip Johnson, and we talked earlier today about his library and
yes, Bobst Library at NYU, where unfortunately students find themselves compelled to throw themselves into the atrium. They go from being.
There was actually just another suicide, I think, this week in Bobst.
It was just the day before yesterday. Yeah, and they go from being. You know, Jack White to Bob Splatt.
Yeah.
It's really tragic. And there's nothing eloquent about that building. It's just a big sandstone cube that has a lot of books in it. And Philip said in his own defense that he was very sick when he did that. Well, I don't know that it's a sick building, but it certainly has had some very unfortunate, tragic episodes of students that just couldn't take it and had to throw themselves into the abyss, but which is a tragic eloquence as a way to really express your dissatisfaction with your educational experience. By
you see, you have to be. I believe that there's a danger with the eloquence. Eloquence can sometimes be can appear pompous. And superficial.
And so you think that Farnsworth is not pompous?
If it's you have to be careful that it's not overdone. When it becomes too tight. That's why I believe the magic word in architecture is adequate and approximate and these things almost
good enough.
Yeah, good enough.
Good enough.
Yeah, that's close enough. Yeah, but. Because materials move, and you know very well that there's nothing exact, and there are temperature changes and all that. And that doesn't say that things shouldn't be precise, but our job is to keep out the water.
Well, that's true, and if we made a building totally rigid, it would break.
Yes.
We have to allow in slip joints because there's the thermodynamics in all the... differential movements of all the different materials. Glass moves at a certain amount when you heat it, and steel also, and concrete less so.
Yeah, different plastics. Materials expand at different rates.
Right. And so a well-designed building is a joinery of slip joints. And
when we were up in Cambridge and the John Hancock building, it was all in plywood. Everything was popping out because of.
Because the glass was ill-designed for the size of the panel. I can't speak English anymore.
Well, the Guggenheim, you ought to talk about it.
Well, no, opera. I picked some operatic music because opera has very much to do with the promenade, which is one of the different sort of... experiences in a taxonomy of pedestrian spaces that have interested me a great deal. And an opera in the 19th century was a place for people to go to see and be seen, and that prototypical archetypal horseshoe shape is ideal, more ideal for seeing the other opera goers than for actually viewing what's going on stage.
The entry is actually bigger than the theater. You know, that gathering place where you
exactly
hang around, and the Paris Opera.
Well, the Opera Garnier. So do you think that's over the top? I think that's eloquence.
I think that's eloquence. I think that is Baroque. Opera is Baroque.
Well, yes, it is a Baroque. It is a Baroque form.
And is the Sydney Opera House, does it say opera?
Yes, it does.
It does?
I don't know. It's plumes. It's so many Spanish helmets stacked up together. I'm ready for a conquistador opera when I see that. To me, it says, ta-da, we are here. You don't agree.
Right. I think it could be a mall. It could be...
No, it could never be a mall.
It could be...
Its verticality defies retail.
I don't know.
It could only be a series of great halls where fabulous acoustical experiences happen.
No,
either that, or a shrine for a variety of deities, one in each of the shells.
When you first saw that, did you think sail or shell?
Shell.
Right, and now it was supposed to be sails.
Yeah, but it's in a harbor, and there are shells in the water.
Well,
you know,
sails are fabric.
Yes, it doesn't have it does not have a tensile shape.
No,
they're shells.
It's a stress skin condition.
But they are honest shells.
Well, they didn't want to make him honest, and that's why he quit. I believe that is an
honest in that they are thin shell structures, which is a special structural type where the shape actually is bearing the weight, and the thickness of the structure can be very, very thin.
Very thin.
And it can be extremely efficient in terms of materials.
They make dams out of
thin shell concrete.
Yeah.
If you have the contour correct.
An eggshell is a thin shell structure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's...
But you can't make an omelet without breaking them. All right.
I saw the Sharoon, the Berlin Philharmonic.
Yeah,
and
which also has shells.
Yes, but again, you know, the lobby area is huge, and it's like you say, it's a promenade. It's being seen. I guess it's showing off your Sunday best, but it's a pomp and ceremony that is. Once in a while, that's why I ask my students. I dress up for them, and
yes, you do.
And
a beautiful bow tie and a beautifully pressed shirt and a nice jacket, and they all showed up in anoraks.
Well, sometimes they show up in ties. I never know, but they say that a couple of sessions ago they dressed up. And they're in the class, they're all wearing ties, and they want to know what's going on, you know? They think something important is happening.
Absolutely.
And everyone wants to know what's going on. It caused a stir in the studio. It's good to dress up once in a while.
Yes. Well, apropos of the promenade, and of opera, and of curvy, voluptuary experiences, something that's more accessible to people here in metropolitan New York, is the Guggenheim Museum, which for me would make a fabulous lobby for an opera house. What do you think about that? You know, you've got the ramp.
You know, I wonder how it would be if there was a performance in there, what the acoustics would be like.
I think they would probably be pretty good.
Yeah. They should try that sometime.
That would be great.
Yeah. Instead, what they always try to do is clog up the space.
Yeah, fill it with something.
Yeah, fill it with something.
Not the void, but rather that open space seems to disturb
They call it a void.
But it's not a void. A void is the absence of something. What it's full of is the interaction of the energy of people looking across at each other.
Yeah, it's a charged space.
It is. It's one of these energy vortexes.
Yeah.
And as you quite appropriately mentioned earlier today, the way to experience it is to take the elevator to the top and then promenade down. Now, I happen to know this myself because I was one of these strange children who was always interested in architecture. And I just happened to be watching the Today Show as a young kid before going to school. And Hugh Downs and Frank Lloyd Wright were touring the Guggenheim. It was about to open. It was still under construction. And Wright took Hugh Downs on the Today Show on a tour of the Guggenheim and said, you must start at the top and then promenade down because that is the flow of gravity. That's why we have machines to take you to the top, but then you have your own 2 feet and your own 2 eyes to experience art from near and far across the rotunda. And what a wonderful thing it is. Unfortunately, the elevator is very small because they never anticipated the thousands of people just showing up that art would become the new religion and that people would go out as a sense of religious devotion to the high altar of art. You know, it was really just a very large, small gallery.
There's a show there now, the Kandinsky Show.
Yeah.
And I just thought that the people in the Guggenheim, they see the ramp as one big continuous space, and I see it as, all right, it's an interior street where you have different things happening along the way. You don't have, they have this tendency to fill the entire thing with the same artists. You know, and it was too much Kandinsky.
Yes.
You know, it was just too much. And you want to scream after, why couldn't they have made a little piece of the journey, you know, the preamble and related artists or different
other
things,
people pay,
you know,
at the
other
same
people
time.
Pay, and make it a whole big chronological kind of experience. It is a chronological experience, but it's just the one artist. And they beat the bushes and pull out every work that he's ever done. And they're all alike. He didn't go through too many phases.
Now, do you think that kind of undercuts the eloquence of the building? I think it's a very eloquent building.
Yeah.
And I can tell you why.
I like it because I really don't have a problem with it. You know, they talk about Frank Lloyd Wright being antagonistic to the city and the building is negating the city. But, you know, we can, it's when you have too much of one thing that it's a problem. But you can have one of it.
Yes, you can have one Guggenheim building breaks the box of the grid.
Yeah, too much grid is not good.
You know, originally he wanted to put the Guggenheim in Central Park.
Yeah.
But I think it's much stronger being in the grid.
Yeah.
Across from the park.
Yeah, yeah. It works.
It does.
It works very well. And,
I'll tell you what I find really eloquent about the Guggenheim. It's the manipulation of scale. Because when you enter, the space, when you go through the revolving door, is very low.
Yeah, yeah.
It's about 7 feet high. Yeah. And that plane
And it just explodes.
Is oppressive.
Yeah.
And then you enter the rotunda, and the space explodes.
Yes,
And
it's very dramatic.
A great sense of relief. And the natural light from the skylight.
And
the absence of noise from the street. Suddenly, you're in a fantastical interior garden, and you know there's a water feature down there, you know, at the bottom.
Yeah, you know, there's something about Frank Lloyd Wright that it never comes out, and I've always noticed it because I'm obsessed with this icon, and it's the Vesica Pieces.
Spell that.
V-E-S-C-I-A, P P-I-S-C-E-S. And it is that thing that is, it's an almond shape. They call it a mandorla.
Oh, yes, yes.
And Christ and Majesty.
The overlain interstices of three circles.
Two circles is fine. Circles. Right. Yeah, and that shape is a vesica. Now, it's all over the museum, and it's a symbolic womb, symbolic vagina, I should say.
Well, it has a lot to do with...
all over the world, that's what
Georgia O'Keeffe.
Georgia O'Keeffe uses it. Everywhere you see it, it's
a magical symbol.
It's a symbol of the cult of the Virgin, and that's their symbol. And it's on every Gothic cathedral, and that is the gateway to heaven, and I can go on and on about that, but... It's all over his buildings, and he uses interlocking circles in a way that is very sensuous.
Yeah.
And I think that when you walk into a Gothic cathedral through that pointed arch, a pointed arch is really that thing dissected horizontally. And it made it, finally the Christians found their form with that. But when you walk through the portal of a Gothic cathedral, you're entering the Virgin Mary. It is a it is
talk about eloquence.
Yes, and but you're not aware of it, and it is. But you are subliminally. It registers as something sublime.
You've been hanging out with Robert Campbell a lot lately.
Robert Campbell.
Yeah, the mythology and iconography guy.
No, as a matter of fact, I believe I'm the only one that actually. It talks about this. I mean, I'm not I've heard of this before, but I had never
made the connection that half of a vesica is the pointed Gothic arch, and you're entering the Virgin Mary. That's your special contribution to the iconography.
Yeah, no, because the Gothic cathedral, when you go in it, it is supposed it assimilates. The glass, the leaded, it is this thin membrane that is, and it's sort of like a interuterine experience. It's just bursting with this divine, fecundity. And it's very feminine, and it is, the church says, religion is sex. You don't get sex till you go to heaven.
Hail Mary, Mother of God.
Yes, and it's they're all brides of Christ and that sort of thing. It's very complex.
Pray for us sinners now. And
but the Catholic Church knows very well the power of this symbol.
Well, I'm going to give the end credits now, and instead of going out on Keith Jarrett. I'd like to go out on Richard Strauss, but don't roll it till I...
How about burning down the house?
No. We already burned down the house. I'll cue you up, but let's just say this has been burning down the house on heritageradionetwork.com. Engineered by Nat Wiener, produced by Jack Inslee. Brought to you by Fairway Markets, a fabulous resource for the ingredients of a good life. Now,
there are two sessions to follow.
Yes, we're going to talk about eloquence with students from the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art next week and the week after. Now, let's have some virginal music.